Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. We're looking back at some of our favourite stories of the year. One man this year broke the record for the longest time living underwater, nearly 100 days at the bottom of a lagoon. But we don't live underwater anymore. Our ancient ancestors may have, but we've long lost that ability to breathe. Ryan Kearney from Gettysburg College, Pennsylvania, is an organismal biologist specializing in the ecology, evolution, and development of amphibians. He's here to help me figure out why humans can't breathe underwater. Welcome to the program, Ryan. Before we go into the question at hand, tell me a little bit about your work. What do you study?
Thanks so much for having me. My topic of study is largely focusing on comparing aspects of development between different groups of amphibians, frogs, salamanders primarily. And one thing that we've really gravitated towards is trying to understand respiratory structures, how lungs develop, what are the rules for the formation of lungs, and even somewhat more arcane aspects of how embryos without lungs are capable of respiring, and what are the rules of gas exchange that exist for different times of development.
Yeah, I'm somewhat rusty on the time scales, but our ancient ancestors lived in the sea. We're pretty sure about that. And at some point, we must have been in a sort of midway stage, as many amphibians are, where we could do both. That's the guess, right? Do we know that for sure?
Yeah, we have a fantastic fossil record, as well as living outgroups that are related to us as tetrapods that breathe with lungs. One of those outgroups is actually a group of fish called lungfish, and they have lungs. As well, there's other what are called rayfin fish, the much larger group of what you mostly think of as fish, that have something similar to the lung called the air bladder that regulates their buoyancy in the water. And recent molecular evidence has really shown us that that air bladder is made the same way as the lung. So we now say that those structures are the same by descent, and that the lung is a modified air bladder that allows us to have terrestrial respiration.
Right. Okay. And so when you look at some of these amphibians or reptiles that have moved onto land, a lot of the time we do see sort of, is it vestigial the right word? Pieces of anatomy that are no longer used, you know, such as legs on snakes and so on. Do we see anything like that in humans, or is it so far back in our past that we don't have sort of the remnants of what might be gills anywhere?
Well, interestingly, we do. Wow. And so it's a bit of a surprise. But because of the way human embryos go through very similar stages of all vertebrates, really, and even further back for wider relationships, we have similar patterns in our early development. And this is really played out within the head. In the formation of our head, we have a series of these really discernible arches of tissue that come down that are going to form different bones of our face and have really interesting cell populations that are doing very dynamic activities within them.
I'm going to post on Twitter a video of a sort of a sped up version of this, which I saw on the internet probably a decade ago now. And it really stuck with me how our face is nothing like our face as we develop in the early ages, right? It just comes together in this way. Our eyes move all over the place. Our nose appears out of nowhere. Our face comes together. And that's why we have that cleft. We have that palate. And some people, that doesn't come together well, and they have a cleft palate. It's just fascinating how this face emerges out of just what seemed like weird, you know, pieces that shouldn't be where they are, and then they just kind of stick together.
It's remarkable. I mean, it's like these blobs of tissue that come down and seal up around the midline.
Yeah.
And then you can see the perforations of the, you know, the outside of the nose, the external nares. And then like the mouth doesn't form until later as it's breaking through of making tissue. But one thing that is conserved are these regions between those bulges, which are in us, they largely don't contribute to any significant anatomical divisions, but in fish, those are the gills. Those are the gill arches. We have one that's persistent, and that's the Eustachian tube. So if you have a clogged ear and you pinch your nose, blow out as a diver, or if you yawn, you can open that back up. That's a connection between our pharynx and the external ear, which is our one persistent gill arch, although it doesn't have any respiratory gills within it. And so we do have some of this baggage in terms of our anatomy from our ancient gill-bearing ancestors that does show up within our development, does persist as these vestiges that don't have the same function for respiration. And I mean, one thing that's interesting when you look across vertebrates is that they're really capable of breathing through a lot of different structures. So we have gills within vertebrates. We have lungs, obviously. But we also have a lot of examples of vertebrates breathing through random things, such as their tails, or many groups through their skin. And this variation in where you can breathe, your what we call the respiratory integument, is one of the remarkable features of how anatomy can be kind of modular. Physiology can be modular. We can make up new ways of doing things, so long as we follow the basic rules of creating a decreasing concentration gradient of oxygen coming in and carbon dioxide going out.
Wow. That is so cool and fascinating. So we see the remnants of these gills, and obviously it was just advantageous to us to prosper on land. Obviously, we probably had some branches of our evolution that did better in water or whatever, but humans adapted well to their environment, thrived and so on, and that's why we live on land. It's why we don't need those gills anymore. But what is it that's actually stopping us? When we return from the water, we obviously choke and drown if we try and breathe in water. But there's oxygen in there. Like, it's, as I said in the promo, it's the O in H2O. Why is it so hard for us to extract that oxygen from water compared to from air? What's stopping us?
Well, clearly the vast majority of animal life is better at it than we are. In that we have life in the oceans that is extremely diverse and capable of respiring, getting that oxygen. And their cells are no different from ours in needing that oxygen to drive, to make an energy available from their diet that will then drive all their metabolic processes. But our plumbing is just wrong. And so the function of a gill is to run blood in the opposite direction of water, and to strip out as much oxygen in the course of that, what is called a countercurrent exchange, as possible, to maximize the amount of oxygen that's taken back up into the circulatory system of like a fish. And in the process also of depositing as much carbon dioxide as possible back into the water. And this is the same thing that goes on within our lungs, but we just don't have that same countercurrent mechanism that a gill-bearing fish would have. So that's one of our major obstacles. Now, some people have experimented in therapeutics and in rodents at looking at highly, highly oxygenated liquids, these perfluorocarbons, which are able to deliver a concentration gradient of really steep concentration gradient of oxygen and deliver it into the blood system through our lungs. And so that's one potential avenue, but there's some real problems with getting that carbon dioxide back out into the perfluorocarbons at the rate that we need to. And so it's not possible to really respire liquid yet, even with perfluorocarbon respiration as a potential alternative. There's some really ingenious biomedical ideas from the engineering world, patent applications for ways to deal with this carbon dioxide problem and to sufficiently remove that. But right now we can't respire out that carbon dioxide using something like a highly oxygenated liquid.
Is there a required compression as well to circulate the liquid? Because I'd heard about these perfluorocarbons that basically it's almost like liquid oxygen, and that we could theoretically extract enough oxygen to breathe, but our lungs can't inflate and deflate. Because they don't have there's no muscle there to do that. Is that one of the other issues?
Not that it's a goal for birds right now, but they probably would be much better at it, because their lungs are adapted as kind of like a a radiator. It comes in and then goes out in a unidirectional flow. And so the gas exchange goes across kind of like a fishgill in that countercurrent mechanism across a respiratory integument. We have what's called tidal respiration. Just like low tide, high tide, we breathe in a gas mixture that's higher in oxygen. We breathe out a gas mixture that is relatively higher in carbon dioxide, but still has oxygen in it. That's why you can do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And so just the mechanics of our plumbing can't necessarily do enough of this tidal respiration to exchange those molecules right. as needed for us. Now, you know, people have been diving for a really long time with compressed air as a way of, you know, keeping people alive underwater. And then there's, you know, additional restrictions physiologically on that in terms of how long you can spend underwater.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was doing biology, I heard that, you know, that we breathe out CO2. And I thought that we just, you know, for a long time, I thought just we breathed out pure CO2. And I couldn't figure that out. So when we look at animals like whales, for example, or lots of other seafaring creatures that need to breathe air, they can stay underwater for hours at a time. And yet we are lousy at this. I mean, really, really poor. 4 minutes would be an amazing achievement for the average person, right? There'll be, well, you know, there'll be something to achieve. Why are we so bad at that? Why can't we extract oxygen better through our lungs? Because presumably we don't take all the oxygen out of one breath. Do we? Like, what is it that's happening in our lungs when we go underwater and we start to feel like, what is that? Is that a poisoning of carbon dioxide, or are we not getting enough oxygen? What's going on?
Now, it is a little bit of both, but the limits of human endurance when it comes to free diving has really been pushed as people take on more and more extreme deep dives and are able to, not through an evolutionary process, but through training and modifying their own physiology, push the envelope. And that remains remarkable, exceptionally dangerous, but remarkable to see the limits that people are able to push when it comes to free diving. But then over evolutionary timescales, we have a sort of much longer period of opportunity to select for better and better free diving abilities. And that has been done as the life aquatic has been readopted by multiple groups of vertebrates, multiple groups of tetrapods that are already living on land. So we have it in marine reptiles like the ichthyosaurs or the what looks like Nessie, Loch Ness monster, the plesiosaurs. We have it in, of course, marine mammals where they've gone back, and we have it in sea snakes. And in all of those groups, as far as we're aware, none of them have re-evolved gill respiration. They all have some form of tidal respiration. And
so how can they can do that so much better than we can? Like, is there enough oxygen? If I were to take a deep breath, I mean, it's clear that there is. If I take a deep breath, it's clear that there must be enough oxygen that to keep me alive for 30 minutes, because that's what free divers do. And yet, after 4 minutes, I'm dying, or 2 minutes.
Yeah. So they have ways of changing both their circulatory system so that they're not overusing energy to draw oxygen off of their lungs. They have ways of modifying the ribs so that they don't necessarily collapse, or so that they can voluntarily collapse, so that they're at depth and not pushing against that extreme external pressure. And they have some mechanisms of dealing with this problem that humans have had to deal with for a while called decompression, or the bends. Where if you're basically in a compressed air environment for whatever reason, diving being one of the most common, and decompress too quickly, you'll get something called decompression sickness. And this is due to not oxygen, but typically nitrogen gases that will leave your circulatory system, enter into your tissues, and then as you decompress, it'll basically phase change back into a gas and create these bubbles. And those bubbles can be exceptionally painful and can lead to not only debilitating diseases, but also death, depending on where they form.
Yeah, And it's a well-known phenomenon that you get drilled into if you do your diving certification. So what about the future, Ryan? Like, is it possible that we might find a way to breathe seawater? Because, you know, I'm sure it's not just my dream. I'm sure it's lots of people's dream to be able to explore the oceans without dying. I mean, that would be fantastic. So you know, is there a way that you've seen or you've heard of that might be possible to engineer a way of breathing underwater?
There certainly are a lot of creative engineering approaches that have been taken in order to get over the issues that we have with the decompression sickness and with the gas exchange. These have included things like liquid respiration, as well as pressurized suits that don't then require a decompression step. But they're clunky, expensive, and pretty risky.
Yeah.
As a biologist, you know, my perspective, my appreciation too is to see what evolution has come up with. And so it's very interesting in the exceptionally successful groups of whales and other marine mammals that they can live these exceptional lives in the sea, but always have to come up for air. You know, something that early whaling industry took great advantage of it in order to hunt them down was that they have to blow. They have to come up and exhale and inhale. And that despite the fact that embryonically they form these gill clefts, they never reformed gills, which indicates that we're at something of a anatomical dead end or developmental dead end when it comes to our evolution to then re-evolve those types of ancestral structures because of something in the mechanisms of our development precluding that, making it impossible. Now, there's other clever ways that critters have managed to respire underwater. Sea snakes are a great example in that we have this very minimal gas exchange across our skin, but they have ramped it up significantly. While we have about 1% to 2% of gas exchange through our skin, they're up to about 30%. And so some of these sea snakes that live in the pelagic ocean, they don't do the gills. They have found a different way. They still need some respiration, but they're able to deep dive and be really active for long periods of time by turning their skin into a breathing organ, into that respiratory integument.
So what you're saying is we'll never get to live under the sea again, or at least it would take quite a long time to evolve those abilities. Guys, really fascinating stuff. I learned a lot from it. So thanks so much for joining us. That is Ryan Kearney from Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. Thanks, Ryan.
Absolute pleasure, John. Thank you.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.